This episode of The Seminarian is sponsored by Asbury Theological Seminary. They know how to tell that story. They make you feel like my kids are going to grow up without a dad unless I buy the next Apple Watch. You know, like I got to buy this thing.
Seminarian. Noun. A student in a theological seminary. Duh.
Hey everyone, and welcome to The Seminarian, where we talk about seminary life, theology, and the things that form us as Christians. I'm Josh.
And I'm Joe. And in today's episode, we're discussing a course that we got to take together called Gospel Catechesis.
Yep, Gospel Catechesis. It was hilarious because when we first started this class, the professor even asked, does anyone know what the word catechesis means? If I just say catechesis...
What?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, what is the first thing that comes to mind? And some people were like, is that the tombs that, you know, people were buried in ancient times, catacombs?
Yeah.
But some people actually had experience with, you know, maybe going through a catechesis or a catechism. And so we're able to kind of enlighten
usually
the rest
associated
of us
with the Catholic Church.
Right.
And their process of being instructed before baptism and stuff like that.
Yeah. So this was, again, the class was called Gospel Catechesis, but we wanted to just kind of give a course review and explain some of the main key takeaways of the class and what we found interesting. But before we get started, maybe do you want to jump into what is catechesis, Joe?
Yeah, catechesis, it comes from a Greek word, katecheo, which basically just means to instruct, or in the passive, to be instructed.
Okay. Yeah. And what we kind of learned through the class is catechesis is used in a variety of ways, but mostly in church history, it was used in preparation for baptism.
Right.
There would be those that wanted to be inducted into the church proper called catechumen, and they would go through a series of classes and they'd learn theology, doctrine, key practices of the early Christian faith. And then sometimes they'd even have like a mentor or a sponsor.
Sponsor is what they were called, yeah.
And that, and they would kind of sign off on these guys. They're ready to be baptized. So it was very different from today.
Maybe. So you have these rites of initiation in the church, baptism being the primary one, along with the Eucharist.
Yeah.
And, but the way they viewed it is that it wasn't, you didn't just start with that. You need to be prepared for that. You need to be trained and taught the basic teachings of the church and the faith before you could be initiated.
Right. And so that was early church practice, really from what, second or third century, until you kind of get into this thought of like infant baptism. And we're not going to fully get into baptism. I'm just trying to give the context for what catechesis in its original context was, preparation for baptism, preparation for the Eucharist or for the Lord's Supper. And so you have these different related words of catechesis. A catechism is an instruction. You may have heard of, for instance, the Westminster's catechism, larger or smaller catechism, Luther's larger catechism, those type of ideas, bodies of work, of teaching. And it's kind of this one-stop shop for Christian theology. And you presumably, I've never taken a catechism class, but you would go through each of these lines or stanzas.
Except for this one.
Except for this one. That's right. And then catechetical just means things that relate to the process of catechesis. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So and maybe to demystify it a little bit, we in modern times, I mean, there are groups obviously that just straight up use the term catechesis, but we would be more familiar with like discipleship or discipleship curriculum, you know?
Yeah.
If there's some kind of curriculum that you go through, maybe it's like a new believer's class at church. That would be catechesis.
Right.
You know, if there's a baptism class, that'd be catechesis.
Something we learned in the class too was while those are examples of catechesis, it's broader than that even. It includes and incorporates liturgy, symbolism, and all of these rites.
Iconology.
Stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not as simple as just going to a class. That's part of it, but it's a much fuller and ongoing process too.
Right, right. It's like a lifelong process. Right. Again, I think more classically it's seen as preparation for those initiation rites, right, like you were saying, but we should...
That's like the beginning of it.
Right. But I mean, if we think about, you use the word liturgy. So yeah, that was a huge part of the class, and learning what liturgy is. Basically, it's a ritual. It's a worship expression that is shared by a congregation or a group of Christians, and things like the liturgical calendar, which I think almost everybody is probably familiar. You may not have heard that phrase, but if you think of, okay, Advent season, or, you know, Christmas and kind of the weeks leading up to that, yeah, and Advent calendars, or Easter, Resurrection Day,
or Lent.
Lent, all of these things, yeah, have to do with the liturgical calendar. And so we learned a lot about that, which was cool because we were raised in a faith tradition that uses the liturgical calendar.
Yeah, so that it was pretty new, at least the terminologies and stuff. In some ways, it was like, oh yeah, we already do that, but we just don't call it that, like discipleship or
right,
things like that. But it was pretty new, a lot of the concepts.
Yeah, so different kinds of liturgy. We already mentioned the liturgical calendar. You know, we also learned that Epiphany, I hadn't known about that before, when yeah, Jesus was baptized and it was kind of his start of his public ministry. It's an epiphany, or revealing to everyone,
right,
this is God's only son whom he's well pleased. And that kind of launches Jesus into his ministry.
Right. And along those lines of, we're talking about the liturgical calendar and catechesis, the whole point is sort of encompassing, like
the life immersive, of Christ, yeah,
like an immersive discipleship and discipling, where it's not just teaching and you get these 3 points and you have to memorize it. It governs your life, you know, the rhythms of life and those types of things. And it helps to form you over time.
I thought you were going to mention it being emulating Jesus's life.
That too.
Yeah. So both are amazing points. It's supposed to be a very 9-to-5, not a like topical kind of, oh, now I'm going to study this arbitrary aspect of Christianity. Like, you're submersed in it, like you said. Your very calendar is being oriented around an ancient Christian faith, but specifically it mirrors the life of Jesus. So it kind of starts, so to speak, in the new year during Christmas time with Advent,
right,
with the birth of Jesus. And then you go through different periods of Jesus's life. Obviously, you have the resurrection, the ascension, and then you have Pentecost as well, the giving of the Holy Spirit, and then it kind of starts all over again.
Yeah.
And it's a really cool way of thinking about time and even the calendar being a means of discipleship or catechesis.
The idea of immersing yourself into Jesus's life and having that be formative for your own life is something that I've never considered before, right, you know, like growing up, I mean, we had Christmas, Easter, obviously, but we never like followed kind of a strict calendar, a liturgical calendar, where our whole year was kind of dictated by certain like major days and stuff. I mean, in the secular world, Christmas is a big deal, but other than that, you know, you don't get that emphasis. But to be like, no, our year and our life is kind of following Jesus's life.
Yeah.
Is pretty amazing.
It feels like you're following Jesus.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, again, we weren't raised that way, but it gave us a lot of food for thought about how we want to parent. I've got 5 kids, you've got 2.
Yeah.
And just what would it be like if you were raised that way? Like, it's tradition, it's just what you know during this time of my life, I really give thought to this aspect of Jesus's life.
Yeah. I think it's also really powerful for raising kids, like you said. Even in our own family, this last Christmas, we really kind of focused on Advent. And we did kind of Advent liturgies every day.
So cool.
But we would light a candle, an Advent candle,
yeah,
as a family. And then I would talk about how Jesus is the light of the world, you know, like coming into the world and coming into the darkness. And then I would talk about him coming back. And even our 2-year-old daughter would kind of catch on to that.
That's so cool.
And I think it was really powerful to like turn off the lights and like turn on the candle and it like lights up and it's just kind of cool. And she loved it. But then also amazes me is afterwards, she would even be like, Jesus coming back? Like,
wow,
Jesus coming home kind of thing. And it was just like, whoa, like just that. We did like a couple times, you know? And it like already kind of like had an impact on her.
So basically the ancient church kind of a little bit knew what they were doing.
They knew what they were doing.
My goodness. And that's funny too. That's an interesting point. And we rubbed against this a couple times. It's like, what is the reticence or the conflict, I guess, of modern churches? Obviously there are a bunch that use liturgical practices, but a lot of them are like, no, we don't want to do that. You know, that's antiquated, or it's legalistic, or it's, I don't know. There's a lot of reticence to embrace this kind of thing, even though it's been used for hundreds and hundreds of years. And anecdotally, your family found it very useful and enlightening.
Yeah, literally enlightening. But I think, for a long time, our culture has been, especially in our context, which is, you know, contemporary Christian,
non-denominational,
evangelical, non-denominational, don't really ascribe to any specific tradition. But I think, and I think I've heard this, that more recently, a lot of these congregations are starting to shift back towards some of those church traditions and liturgies and stuff like that, especially in the wake of a post-Christian world that we're living in now. Some people are wanting to steer back towards that.
There's a renaissance of going down the ancient paths and and bringing all of those very time-tested, valuable things back to our 2024. Yeah, it's cool too, because again, at first, I don't know why I had a little bit of a chip on my shoulder, but I was kind of like, doesn't this kill authenticity if, like, you know, if sermons, every sermon every year on this day is going to be pretty much the same? There are other means, like the Common Book of Prayer that we learned about, which is just another liturgical device where each day has a set prayer. It's got either a church father or a saint or some kind of Christian figure from antiquity that you learn about, and you're like, what can we glean from this? And there's responses. And to me, at first, it just felt very robotic and inauthentic. And I was kind of like, I don't know if I like this. It's good to learn about this, but I don't know if I'd actually use this. And then as it kind of went on, I started to see the value in it.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I think we do see value in repetition in other areas of our life, you know, doing things again and again.
I knew what repetitious meant.
Yeah. Oh, man, yeah. Well, I feel like I have to explain things for you, but I'm just kidding. It's for my own good, and I totally lost my train of thought. So
you were like that we see value in doing things repetitiously.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then you said, and doing it again and again.
But I think we like new things, though.
Yes, of course.
In our culture, like, we value new, the next thing, the newest, the latest, whatever. And oftentimes, we view tradition negatively, like old things, you know, old, dead, or whatever, you know.
As nothing left to give us.
Yeah, we don't feel that has value. But we like new things, so we'll do things like on our iPhone repetitiously, like religiously, repetitiously. But it's new, you know, and we think that's exciting.
Well, we think it's new.
That's an amazing point.
I think that leads us to kind of a next discussion. So this class, I know we're just kind of diving into what catechesis means, but this class, essentially the way it was structured was there was, I don't remember, 5 or 6 primary textbooks. And we would read those, write a paper about them, and have class discussion on them. The professor would give instruction and maybe some teaching on that, and then we'd move on to the next textbook. One of our first ones, was it our first one? No, it was our second textbook, was a book called You Are What You Love by James K.A. Smith. And he actually talks a lot about what you were just describing of the liturgy of how we use our cell phones.
Yeah.
That it's repetitive, it's almost ritualistic, it's almost a religious experience in terms of, I mean, you could literally look at what it does to, like, brain chemistry and just be like, oh, wow, something is happening here that is a very...
It changes you.
Almost sacred practice. It's very formative. Exactly. Yeah. And so let's talk a little bit about that book, You Are What You Love, because I think that that was a fascinating concept I hadn't really given any thought to before.
Right. So the... One of the premises of the book is the idea that we're not just brains on a stick, is how he put it. Right. We're not just thinking people. We don't just think and act based on what we think. but rather we're driven, our motivations and our actions are driven and formed by the things that we love.
Yeah, so we're not thinking brains, we are desirous hearts,
right?
Primarily, that we're not thinking rational machines, though that is a part of us,
right?
That down in our nucleus, we are motivated by just the things that are around us that we end up wanting. So we're influenced by things around us that yeah. shapes us. It sells us on something. It gives us a picture of what he calls the good life, yeah. right? So there's some kind of convincing that takes place of this is how I get the good life. And then our hearts right. attach ourselves to that thing and we envision it. And then we don't even know it, but subliminally we are motivated by trying to get that thing. And our decisions are made out of that.
Right.
yeah.
And you can see it in the advertisement world. They totally. Have caught on to this. They know, they really do know what they're doing. They know how to get you hooked on the next thing.
I've cried, confession, I have cried at Apple commercials before.
Oh my gosh.
I know, I'm an Apple fanboy, and it just shows that like-
I like Apple too, but my goodness.
I'm just saying, some of them are like, they're talking about yeah. how Apple Watches like save people's lives. And he's like, I wouldn't be here with my kids today if my Apple Watch didn't, you know, detect that I was about to have a heart attack. It was like, I think it was the Apple Watch 9 commercial. And it's just about how many people's lives have been saved by Apple Watches. And dude, they know how to tell that story.
Right.
They make you feel like my kids are going to grow up without a dad unless right. I buy the next Apple Watch. You know, like yeah. I got to buy this thing.
Yeah, they know how to tug on your heartstrings.
yeah, them and Pixar, dang it.
Also, though, another element is honestly, we're just addicted to using our phones.
No, we're not.
That's denial. That's the first stage.
Yeah.
the first step.
Totally, though.
We're addicted to just opening up our phones. Like, I mean, how many times you just like look at your phone, you know, and like.
You're not even thinking. You just, your finger finds its way to Facebook or Instagram right. or whatever. You're scrolling and it was not an intentional, oh, I want to look at Facebook now. Yeah. It was just, it happened.
Yeah, you find yourself on whatever, Bunny Trail or whatever, you're on YouTube, whatever. Yeah. And it's just, you're like, how did I get here? How did I get to this point?
And it is like magical. Mindless. I mean, if I just think about this, if I just touch my phone in the right places, pizza will show up at my door.
Yeah.
Mind blown.
We're just mice. We're all just mice. You know how they train them to like push this button to get fed or something? Like,
how do you get the pizza?
How do you get the pizza? Ours is just more complicated.
exactly.
It's basically the same thing.
But that's what James Smith talks about in this book is we are being trained to want certain things according to the culture. Obviously, it's all being driven by money.
Right.
He uses this term rival liturgies.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
So rival liturgies it's rivaling church liturgy, basically. Rivaling liturgies that have been handed down from the church that are designed to transform us and to like form us into the people of God. The rival liturgies are these like secular liturgies. It's liturgies outside of that. That are trying to pull our hearts and pull us away from the kingdom of God, as he puts it, and to seek after, like you said, a different end, a different telos, yeah. as he puts it. But
a telos is a fulfillment of something, right?
An end, yeah.
An end. So we had to do a group project that was super fun. And it was basically just arbitrarily pick a rival liturgy, and I want you to parallel Christian worldview, Christian liturgy, this whole process of catechesis. What is the catechesis of something secular? And so we got into a little group. It was a hybrid course. So we had 3 days where we had classmates and the professor came to Colorado Springs and we chose football as our rival liturgy. And I mean, that's low hanging fruit because there are so many aspects that football just mirror religion, essentially. And so we just started making a list. How is football?
It was too easy.
Yeah, it was.
It was like it was written out. The playbook was already written out for us.
Oh, you know? I see what you did there. But I mean, it's like, okay, just imagine you've got this stadium that is like the temple or the cathedral or the church of football where people congregate in. And just like you might, you know, wear a three-piece suit, or there's some kind of, you dress in a way to go to church. You definitely dress a way to go see a game at right. this temple. You know, you have your, mm-hmm. your uniforms and
your religious garb.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Right. Similar to how you have heroes of the faith or veneration of saints, you have great players and MVPs and Hall of Famers, you know.
Legends.
Yeah. You know? We have doctrine in the church, and then we have commentary, you know, from these very authorized professional, almost like clergy of football, that kind of
right.
talk the language.
They're like interpreting the rules, right? You have like the rule book.
Yeah.
They're interpreting the rules. So that,
they're explaining
and then there's differences
to the layman.
In interpretation. Yeah. It's just like...
Yeah. It's crazy. So you have obviously leadership, you have coaches, the quarterback, referees. You even have statues and icons.
Yeah.
Just like that's been yep. used in the church for a long time to tell a story. You've got that. You go mm-hmm. to a stadium, you're going to see all their great players from way back when, which is yep. crazy. In the church, you might have hymns or worship songs or anthems, and you have theme songs and jingles and,
yep.
you know, ESPN has their little jingle or, you know, Monday
like
night.
Like a lot of churches have like the, like a call to worship kind of thing where it's right. like, here, get your hearts ready, get ready to worship. And it's like right before a game on TV, they just put on like a clip or, and a song and stuff. And it's like, gets you
in your heart
and ready.
I mean, yeah. I'm not a huge football fan, but like if
Me
you
neither.
Are, I'm sure that does something to you.
Yeah.
Like you're like, it's time. Like, come like, on guys.
It's hype time.
Yeah. Let's like, focus. Let's do this.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Totally. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think it was funny. This isn't even on my list, but you know, we have raised hands in worship for maybe more charismatic sides of church tradition. And you've got the same thing. You've got yeah. people raising their hands, doing the wave, you know, just...
It's a full body experience.
Oh, right? Totally.
No one's sitting at a football game unless you're losing or something, you know, but then you're crying. It's like so emotional.
Lament.
It's like yeah. internal, like, you know, but yeah, you're like jumping up and down. You're like screaming. Like, it's just, it's a full body
experience.
You
might literally yeah. be painting your body, a letter, you know,
yeah.
the colors or whatever. Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, there's even superstition in football, which kind of, obviously, the church should
extremely.
Not be superstitious, but in
only a little
eons past, the church was superstitious. And so there was
yeah, points,
things
yeah.
that you're supposed to do. You know, I think it's interesting, too, that the church has denominations. And there's some tribalism there. And in football, there's totally denominations. There's conferences, but then
yeah.
there's also the team tribalism. And it's just funny too, because it's like this idea of, you know, maybe the church might say like, you're a heretic if you don't believe this thing. In football, it's like, if you're a Raiders fan, you are a heretic. You know? Like there's certain teams that like, I hate the Cowboys just personally, just because I was raised to. I mean, they're probably great guys. I don't know, but I've been trained
Yeah, yeah,
tribally.
Exactly. And then the opposite too. I work at Costco, and two people in line totally didn't know each other for sure in different lines. And they were both wearing 49ers shirts.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah.
And this one guy like made a beeline over and was like talking to him about the game that was happening that day. And it was just like, they're like, it's almost like they're buddies now,
yeah.
you know, it's like the community that
yeah,
creates.
Yeah.
It's like, if only we could get that in the church, you know, like,
right. You love Jesus. I love Jesus. No
I know.
Way. You've read the book of Romans. Oh my gosh.
I know exactly.
Yeah. That's so crazy how strong that community is.
The culture it creates. It's just,
yeah. And it's funny too. There's a doctrine in, you know, theology called federal headship, where mm-hmm. Jesus, well, first Adam represents mankind, and by his sin, we're all made sinners. But then obviously Christ is our new federal head, and we are all forgiven and presented as righteous before God. And there's some federal headship in football as well. So, you know, my team, it's we won, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And it represents not just the team that won, like my team won. That's
right.
Awesome. It's like all of us. I'm a winner now before whoever, the football gods.
You
I don't know.
You didn't do anything.
I didn't do anything.
But you can totally brag about it.
But it's like imputed righteousness.
Yeah.
It's like this idea of like, I am awesome because my team went to the Super Bowl. You know, it's just
they take
so
it even
crazy.
A step further with like fantasy football and stuff. Because it's let's not even get into the fantasy football thing. That's a whole nother.
Yeah, that's I don't know. That's heaven. I don't know what that would
another
be.
Another element too is we were talking about the liturgical calendar in the year and the rhythm of life. Well, football, for sure creates a rhythm of life for people. Like throughout the week, right?
Yeah,
you've got days where you have football and days where you don't have football. And people who love football, I know when it's not football, like when it's a day that there's not a game, it's like depressing.
But you have preseason, you have obviously Super Bowl. I mean, there's all of these.
College football.
Right, Turkey Bowl. Like all of these.
When the season ends, everyone's depressed unless they won. But then it's like, they're just like, can't wait till next year. You know, that's like the common time for the church. It's like after Easter until Advent, you know, it's like common.
It's
time,
so
you know, it's
weird.
And it's just like,
and we, I mean, I'm not dogging on football inordinately. I'm just using, there's a lot of these rival liturgies.
Right. And the point is that we actually want that and we actually seek that and create that ourselves.
Right.
So
we are desirous hearts.
Right.
We're not just thinking heads. Something. We want to be, we are liturgical creatures. We want a liturgy. We want a calendar. We want to be part of a community. And it's just using that as an example to show that instead of just being like, liturgy, ew, you know, it's instead it should be, we're built that way, kind of. And how do we capture that in a way that forms us, like you said, into the people of God?
And football is just one example. Cell phone is another example. But the point being, too, is that it's not like you can just like say no to it altogether, you know?
Yeah.
It's like either you're going to be formed by a biblical liturgy or you're going to be formed by the cultural liturgies, you know, secular liturgies.
Yeah. And I think going a little bit back to this good life concept is liturgies are important because they are how you get to, or how, not necessarily like steps to get there, but how you are formed into the person you want to be. Mm-hmm. So it's, what does the good life look like? And then there's a story, there's a narration about, hey, to get there, you need to incorporate these things in your life. Right. So we were talking about Apple. You know, maybe the story of Apple is, hey, if you want to be the modern man, or you want to be holistically integrated with both technology and your family and just being able to have the free time and convenience to live the good life.
Right. You want to be as productive as possible.
Right. Yeah. So you can have time with your family, or you want to capture this moment, this birthday party, or this time on the beach. Like they throw all of this, or you want to be fit, right? Like you want to be just maximized. Yeah. So
and it's all geared towards you.
Of course.
What do you want?
Right.
But they're kind of telling you what you want at the same time.
And they're telling the story that looks amazing. And, and you want to see yourself in that story. For football, I think, you know, the story is, I want to be a champion. I like football because it shows a struggle and it maybe mirrors the struggles that I have, that it's gritty and I just need to overcome that. Or I want to aim for perfection. I want to be the best that I can be, or dominance, or, you know, for, I'm not saying football is just for men, but like, oh, this is a manly thing. If I want to be a real man, it means that I need to love football and all of these things. And so it tells a story that you want.
Yeah.
And I think part of the problem with today is like, we need to get back to telling the story of what does it mean to be a follower of Jesus, and then attaching, because that's what the part of the problem is, it feels detached, attaching liturgy to, you want that? Okay, this is how we're formed into that.
Right.
Is we immerse ourselves in the life of Jesus in a calendar or whatever those things are.
Over time and in repetition.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, which means to do things over and over again.
Really?
And so I thought this class was really fantastic.
Yeah.
We had a great professor named Chris Keisling, and he was just, I really appreciated, even though it was an online, mostly online class, he was very involved.
Yeah.
And so he would comment on our discussions. And
on every post.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You write a paper, he's going to give lots of feedback and honestly make you feel like $1 million. He was just like, you're so smart, or that was so insightful, or whatever. And it just, he did a great job of motivating you to keep wanting to be a part of class. I also enjoyed, I didn't think I'd like it as much as I did, the online discussion part.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's like, I just got to do this.
Right.
But
I think because he was so involved, you knew what you were going to write, he was going to respond to.
Yeah.
Rather than it just be like, oh, I'm just going to throw this out there and then it's like over.
It was actually a discussion between classmates and the professor, which was cool. I liked most of the books. I know we didn't get into it and we're running out of time, but there was a couple of books that gave some of the best explanation to baptism, for instance, and the sacraments.
Yeah.
You know, in kind of the Protestant world, there's baptism and there's the Lord's Supper. Mm-hmm. In the Catholic world, there's seven.
Seven, I think.
Yeah, there's like confirmation, there's penance and reconciliation, anointing the sick, matrimony, which is marriage, and then holy orders. And and so kind of getting into the history of those things was pretty fascinating. But baptism, for instance, there's a lot of debate, like infant baptism, I know I referenced, or is it their decision? Should a child, or, you know, do they need to go through a process of catechesis before they're baptized? And so there was some books that...
How much catechesis needs to happen?
Right. How much do they need to understand?
Yeah.
Do they experience it before they understand it? And that's part of the learning experience.
Right. Because we come from a world where sometimes there'll be spontaneous baptisms on a Sunday where it's just like, whoever raised their hand to accept Christ, come down and be baptized, you know? And there isn't any kind of training at all.
Right.
And so like, how does that fit in?
Yeah, that's kind of like the Ethiopian eunuch story a little bit is kind of the defense for that of just like, hey, what's to stop me getting baptized right now? But then we would do like a baptism class afterwards. And so it's the order, the sequence of that, what is best. And if you've never put any thought into that as a listener, I think that there's some really great, I found there were really great resources, and we'll list some of the books in the show notes for this episode that were just, oh, that's where that came from. Here's the rationality for that. And here's the benefits of doing it this way.
Yeah.
But I also appreciated in this class, there was a lot of humility of like, hey, these things are useful. They're supposed to be tools to equip you as a future pastor or a minister. And just to give you a way to think about structuring your discipleship so that it's traditional, it's time-tested, and you're not just reinventing the wheel a million times over because it's been invented 1,000-plus years ago, and it's shown, I mean, it's why we have Christianity today.
Right, and a big takeaway, too, was just the importance of, or the need for, catechesis in the church today.
Absolutely.
In summary, catechesis is a structured process of instructing believers in the faith. We found this course to be interesting and enlightening, giving us context for many ancient traditions that we previously knew very little about.
Yeah, in addition, these conversations about rival liturgies made us aware to how the secular world competes for our affections and often paints a picture of the good life that is antithetical to that of the Christian faith.
But what do you think? Let us know in the comment section on our Facebook or Instagram post of this episode, and make sure you give us a like.
And also make sure to visit our website, seminarian.life, for show notes and other resources. Until next time, thanks for joining the conversation today.